thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 62, recorded on November the 8th, 2010. PDA in the library? Well, welcome back to another edition of Digital Campus. This is Digital Campus number 62. We were just thinking that perhaps 62 episodes meant that we might be the longest running podcast in history. So some kind of an award for longevity, I'm sure, would be in order. But we're podcasting away from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason, and I'm Mills Kelly from edwired.org. Joining me today is Dan Cohen, director of our Center for History and New Media. Dan, how's it going?
All right. How you doing, Mills?
I'm doing quite well. Enjoying the fall weather here in Virginia.
Me too.
And also our newest podcast regular, Amanda French from amandafrench.net. Amanda, how are things?
Things are great. They're snowing.
Oh, that's right. You're still Digital Campus North. That's right. So it's actually snowing there in New York, is it?
Absolutely. It was sleeting this morning and now it's snowing.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, it's your fault for living there. And here in the also in the nice weather in the greater Washington area is one of our irregulars on the podcast, Jennifer Howard from the Chronicle of Higher Education and jenniferhoward.com. Jennifer, how are you?
I'm fine, Mills. How are you doing?
I'm doing quite well. I'm doing quite well. Well, we have a number of things to talk about today that we are somewhat surprised by and perhaps not surprised by other things. And I'm going to start with the thing that I'm, I guess, not so surprised by, and that is that the Wikimedia Foundation, we haven't talked about Wikipedia much on the podcast in a while, so I thought we needed to bring it back because the Wikimedia Foundation has recently announced a public policy initiative where professors of public policy, including one from George Mason, where the podcast is based, they're going to do something really surprising, and that is that they're going to have their students write entries for Wikipedia as a way of teaching them about this vast information resource. I say surprising with a certain degree of sarcasm.
And familiar to me.
Yeah, I say that
maybe
with a certain degree of...
Is that like Digital Campus number one?
I think it is, in fact, Digital Campus number one. So, and if you're counting, this was 62 and we go all the way back to one. I don't know how many years ago that was now, but
yeah,
it was
almost four years ago.
And I think our title was, in fact, Wikipedia Friend or Foe. And the in that podcast, a certain podcaster who shall remain nameless talked about assigning Wikipedia to his students and how that worked. And so perhaps what this means is that the folks at the Wikimedia Foundation have begun listening to the podcast at last, and they sort of worked their way all the way back to episode number one. But, you know, I'm being very sarcastic, but I think...
Wait, does this mean you're off of Jimmy Wales' Dead to Me list?
No, I'm quite certain that I'm still on Jimmy Wales' Dead to Me list. And anybody who doesn't know the reference can go back in to edwired.org and look for Jimmy Wales's "You're Dead to Me" comments.
Happy with Mills.
Yes,
we'll put it that way.
Actually, his exact words were "not a fan." So, and also, you know, for those who may remember, for a brief period of time, I was actually blocked from Wikipedia editing. I could actually read it, but I couldn't edit either from home or from my office. Plus, the classroom that I was teaching from that semester, whoever the instructor was who followed me in that class, that IP address was blocked for a little while too. But I'm unblocked. I'm allowed to edit again. I've been forgiven by all but Jimmy. And I mean, what do you guys think about this, about assigning Wikipedia to students?
Well, I have to say it. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Jen.
No, I was just going to say, you know, if part of the idea these days is to teach students about information literacy, maybe it's not a bad idea to have them tackle, you know, directly tackle one of the main and often maligned sources of online information.
Amanda, what about you?
Oh, I mean, I'm all for having students edit Wikipedia. And it's funny because I think we get so much student work, and it's always such a shame that that student work isn't read by other people. It's no wonder that students kind of aim their writing only at the professor because they know that no one else is reading it. So I think in general, opening student work up to other people is always a good thing. And, you know, having them contribute to Wikipedia is something they can see immediately, and they can watch their changes over the course of the, you know, the semester, as you've done, or whatever. I did this with a dance class, actually, down at Emory. They asked me to come in and help them contribute to Wikipedia Dance. There's a whole separate project of Wikipedia. And so the students wrote biographical articles about dancers who only had stubs. That the only thing that I'll say is that I was surprised that this particular article that we're looking at about professors assigning their students to write for Wikipedia is that the issue of privacy doesn't come up, because we get a number of people will maintain, some students among them, that student work is, you know, it is by law private. So really, you're supposed to get release forms from the students before you have them do anything like this, unless they're doing it anonymously, I suppose. But even then, you're really supposed to get a release form. But to my mind, that, you know, usually you ask the students to sign a release form, and they happily do so, and you go along with your work. But that is an issue to be addressed with assignments like this.
Dan, you teach a grad seminar.
We did it this semester. I'll tell you, it's one of the assignments that I like the best. It always works. It's also, as Amanda hinted at, it's kind of the gift that keeps on giving, because they can watch the changes for the rest of the semester. So we did it a month ago or so. I split the class up into four groups and assigned them some, I always like assigning contentious articles. So we looked at four articles. I'm probably going to forget one of them, but I know we looked at Thermopylae, which you wouldn't think was contentious, but the Battle of Thermopylae, Joan of Arc, Hiroshima, and I can't remember the fourth. I knew I was going to forget one. But it was a fascinating, I think, experiment. Just looking through the existing discussions of the sites, you know, this year Hiroshima was particularly interesting because that entry has changed so radically over the past 10 years in the English and in the Japanese language version. And so the students got, I mean, the reason I feel like it has so many facets when you teach this, because they learn about the writing of history in this sort of natural, neutral point of view. They also learn about debates and fact checking and footnoting in the weird way that Wikipedia does that, edit wars, all these things, in the nature of wikis. So there's a lot of different angles to it. What I was going to say before that tangent was just that, you know, Hiroshima, for instance, has changed over the past 10 years from being almost solely about the dropping of the atomic bomb to being about the city itself and the arts of the city in a kind of longer view history, which I think was very instructive for students to see how that changed and how the bomb became just one section in a much broader article about Hiroshima. In the Japanese language version, even though none of us speak Japanese, you could see that change. Actually, we used Google Translate and went back over the edits over the past eight or so years in the Japanese language version of Wikipedia. And you could see very early on there was enormous resistance to making the article about Hiroshima being solely about the bomb, and very quickly moving it into a broader economic, social, and intellectual history of the city. So, you know, I just think it's great to get people involved with Wikipedia. It's much deeper than I think a lot of people imagine when they first see it, or just if they use it just superficially. So it's always effective. Never had a problem teaching it.
Yeah, I will say that the only problem I've had with this assignment that I came up all these years ago is that I used to say to my students, okay, find an entry on the subject that we're working on that either needs to be elaborated on or there is no entry, and so you need to write one. And as Wikipedia is getting built out, it's become increasingly difficult for them to find something like that. So increasingly my assignment turns to editing existing entries rather than creating something new. But it was always a lot of fun to turn the students loose and say, write an entry on a subject that interests you within the general framework of our course. And so when I was teaching Western civilization, that meant sort of all of Western history. And so they had a lot of room to wander around. But I think the student who got the most excited about this was one who, she didn't actually check with me in advance, but she wrote her entry on the only husband and wife serial killers known, the Birnies of Australia. And why she chose that, I really don't want to know. And however, she came into class, she came into class just sort of floating about 3 inches off the floor, because the day after her entry went up, it became the featured entry on the Wikipedia homepage. And so now what is she going to remember about Western civilization? She's going to remember that she wrote a Wikipedia entry that was the featured entry that day. And so if you look up the Birnies, she was the, and you go into the history, it's the creator's handle was OMG, it's Monica. And so that was one of my, that was one of my students.
I'll have to check that.
So great.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
so
pretty rare. Pretty rare for students to get a chance to put writing or ideas in a form that has a billion users. I mean, I don't think people really realize the scale of Wikipedia as a top 10 website worldwide. And so that's just incredible. I mean, when would you normally have the chance to do something like that?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. When would a freshman in college be able to write something that millions and millions of people read that day? So,
I'll say too that, I mean, another assignment that I think one could assign, and something that I did a little bit in my Creating Digital History class last year, is even if there aren't a great many text additions to be made to Wikipedia, I think lots of articles need references and even updated references. So I could see your assignments, Mills, maybe changing from being write this article to source this article, you know, find sources for it, add new sources as they come out, you know, because Wikipedia always needs that. And I think they're very good about being vigilant at making sure that articles are sourced. And when I was working with archivists last year, we looked at articles that said, look, when you link to primary sources in your archives from Wikipedia articles, because a lot of those are online at the item level, you know, the traffic to those items goes way, way up. So particularly for librarians and archivists who know all these unique special collections materials on these arcane topics and know where they are on the web, I really think it's a public service for them to put that in the references to Wikipedia articles.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, I think you're absolutely right. And speaking of libraries and archives, there's been a lot of buzz about libraries the last week or two, in particular about a proposal from Bob Darnton up at Harvard about creating a national digital library. Jen, you had a chance to talk to Darnton about this. Tell us how that conversation went.
Sure. Well, Darnton hosted a top-level gathering at Harvard at the very beginning of October. He got about 42 representatives from the library world, the foundation world. Some of the top foundations were there, including Sloan and Mellon. It's probably wrong to call it top secret, but it was not publicized. Media were not invited, but I called Darnton up afterward just to see how it had gone. And he was really gung-ho about it. He said that everybody was on board with this. Critically, I think he was very pleased with how the foundations felt about it. They all seemed willing to step up and put some cash toward it. So he was actually less worried about the financial outlook for this proposal than he was about the copyright issues, which of course is what Google with its mass digitization project has run afoul of. Darnton seems to think that as far as creating a national digital library or there are various terms one can use for it. It doesn't have to be national per se, but something that would really be overarching, that it's going to be the copyright issues that are the most troublesome, not the financial picture, which surprised me a little bit, but maybe shouldn't have as I thought about it.
Surprises me quite a bit. So why isn't the funding a problem? I mean, doesn't it require, I assume, several hundred million dollars to...
A year.
Probably so. Now, nobody has made public any specific plans about how the financial structure of this thing would work.
Yeah.
They have a game plan of some kind, an action plan, which involves, I think, getting more formal commitments from foundations and putting together some kind of governance structure. It's not clear where that would be housed, if that would be housed at a foundation or at Harvard. I mean, somebody has to be in charge of organizing this, you know, octopus of a project. And I haven't seen any specifics yet. So I'm very curious to see, you know, what kind of projections they're looking at, and how much they can draw on things that are already in place. You know, would HathiTrust be a big part of this? I'm guessing yes, I think. But, you know, I don't know I don't think there are any formal agreements yet.
Well, it's interesting because I've just come from the Digital Library Federation Fall Forum. And for those who don't know what the DLF is, it's a part of the Council on Library and Information Resources, which is a funding organization, and I like to describe it as a library think tank in D.C. And DLF is an organization that's been around for a while, since 1994, and it's been a standard-setting organization, and it's been this essentially consortium is not quite the right word, but association of major research libraries. And the kind of digital library part of that. And so there was some discussion of this at the DLF Fall Forum, but they're the kind of, it's the kind of thing where all of these major research libraries have, as you said, Jen, they've been doing things kind of piecemeal. Even HathiTrust, which takes files that Google Books has digitized and makes those available through a nice little interface. It's not one of these web scale things. Web scale was a term that kept coming up at the DLF Fall Forum. So I think that you know, there was a lot of willingness to be involved. A lot of you know, the perception was everywhere that yes, we as libraries need to band together, club together, and provide something that, you know, everybody would know where to go to find digital books, you know, besides Google. I think there's a lot of willingness there, but yeah, what the administrative organization would look like, what the technical infrastructure would look like, that's still to be determined.
One thing that I was struck by after my conversation with Darnton, I got a note from somebody at a foundation whom I will not name, but he said Darnton is a wonderful guy, you know, great ideas, great champion for this idea, but he's not the only person, you know, who has this idea. There are other people involved in this as well, and that this is a person who was at the meeting, and that made me wonder how organized this group is internally. If they're not even sure what is, you know, who can say what now, who speaks for the group, does anyone speak for them? I'm sure that partly is coming out of a sense that this has to be a collaborative and collective enterprise, but it's such a big idea, somebody has to be a traffic controller of some kind. And they've also gotten tangled up in some of the rhetoric surrounding the project. Some of you may have seen Paul Courant's post about Darnton's use of the term cultural patrimony to describe what the contents of this digital library would be. And that provoked, several people were upset or concerned that Darnton had used this charged rhetoric. I think Darnton used it in what was meant as a constructive way, but it's a term that's fraught for a lot of people. So if they're already getting encountering rhetorical hurdles, I'm wondering how they will handle the more practical and substantive challenges involved.
That's a tactful way of putting it. Yeah.
Well, and for me, I mean, we have such an organization already. It's called the Library of Congress, that is charged by Congress with doing this, although in an analog world. And so I also wonder the degree to which this is going to create some, you know, because I think something like this is going to emerge. It'll probably be a little bit, but I think it will begin to emerge. But I wonder the degree to which whatever emerges is then direct competition to the mission and purpose of the Library of Congress. And at what point then that's going to become a problem.
Well, I will say the LC was part of this this gathering at Harvard. I don't know. I haven't talked to anybody there about what, you know, what their role in this may be, but they are certainly being kept. They're certainly taking part in the conversation now. I guess my feeling is the Library of Congress has so much on its plate, and you know, it's in that curious position of it is our national library, but it's not officially our national library. It is our de facto library, which puts it in kind of a difficult position. Plus, it's supposed to be coming up with a national plan for preserving digital infrastructure. It's got all this, you know, this material it has to do things with already. It's a lot. It's got too much to do already.
I completely agree.
So, Jen, did you get a sense of which path this is likely to go, whether it will be, you know, I think, Amanda, you brought up the web scale notion, and the you know, technology I think about that's web scale is the web, which already has collections that are at endpoints that could be virtually aggregated. And so one version of this project seems to me to be some kind of virtual aggregation, you know, decentralized, but maybe with a centralized interface or search tool to scan these various books or materials, which kind of already exists in some ways, but maybe not to the extent or the ease of use that, say, Google Books has. The other option is more like HathiTrust, where you're actually depositing you know, archival digital copy into some center, which I believe the grid for HathiTrust's at Indiana, I want to say, their main technical infrastructure at IU.
I think it's at Michigan, actually.
Is it at Michigan?
Wrong.
Or maybe there's a couple of centers, but it's still it's a centralized technical infrastructure. Do you get a sense of which way this is going?
I did not get that sense from Darnton. I think he's not really focused on the technical aspects so much. He's more the conceptual standard bearer, if you will.
I wonder too whether he. I could be reading into this a lot, but some of what I get the sense of this is about is simply trying to get Google to donate copies of the things that it has scanned to the nation, to LC or whatnot, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, Darnton made it very clear that this was not an anti-Google gathering. So that's
what, was anyone from Google there?
No, I don't believe they were. I don't know if they were invited or not.
Mm-hmm. And why was it secret? I'm sort of, I mean, even though it wasn't top secret, but why? I guess this is just my way of expressing sadness that I wasn't being invited.
I'm sorry, I wasn't invited to. My impression is that there was some concern that the foundation folks in particular and some of the governmental representatives who were there were not. They didn't want their involvement made too public too early, not because they're embarrassed about it, just because they don't want to. They didn't necessarily want to be committing publicly to anything before they had a chance to hear what was going on. There's kind of a debate about whether it was really a secret meeting or not.
So it was more expectations management than some kind of secret cabal that was.
Oh yeah, definitely, yeah. Definitely. I don't think it was meant to be, you know, exclusionary in a scary sense. More just, this is, you know, there are a lot of people who have foundation people, you know, notoriously sensitive about what they're going to commit to publicly too early. So.
But is there any hope that the copyright issues are going to be overcome by this attempt?
Boy, that's a great question. I don't know, but I'm hearing more and more urgency when I talk to librarians and others about the need for copyright reform. Although, at a recent meeting, not a meeting I was at last week, but a couple of weeks ago, I was somebody was saying, but you know, look at everything that Congress has on its plate. Are they really going to get around to copyright reform right now? You know, this is urgent for librarians and scholars, but maybe not for the people who actually make law.
Certainly not for the next couple of years anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, but also who's, you know, which party is the champion of copyright reform? You know, the Republicans are against it and the Democrats are against it even more. I mean, like, they each have constituencies that are, you know, lobbyists who are against it. I mean, there's no party. Right.
Well, I think at the very least, it's not immediate, but we're going to get some discussion about copyright reform coming up in 6 years or so when you get the Sonny Bono Term Extension Act, you know, is going to run out, right? They reinstated, you know, they lengthened the term of copyright for 20 years back in 1998. So in 2018, Mickey Mouse is going to be in danger of going into public domain again. And I guarantee you that will light a fire under copyright discussions, even if we don't get any before then.
We're about to get a new Register of Copyrights. Mary Beth Peters is retiring, And so
yeah, that's kind that's an interesting hidden story. I mean, with Ed Felton going in into his role at people don't know this, the Princeton professor who's really done a lot of work, I would say in this area of, well, you know, computer security, but also in, you know, working for kind of a fair and open environment for computation in the United States. He's now become the chief technologist for the FTC, which is, you know, really unusual and interesting. He's been the person who's been, he's argued against a lot of these, the Diebold machines, voting machines. He's done a lot of work on their security. You know, he also was a witness in the United States versus Microsoft antitrust trial. You know, I think he's been, by the way, and, you know, saying that he was a critical part of that trial in that he showed that you could uninstall Internet Explorer from Windows, which Microsoft said, no, it's part of the operating system. And he sort of walked in and said, no, here you go. And he uninstalled it. So, so I think that, you know, that and the FTC position and the possibility that you could have, you know, I mean, I doubt this will happen, but a Larry Lessig type person as the copyright officer would, I think, change things.
And the Google book search settlement, if we ever get one or get a ruling on that amended settlement, that may also change the legislative picture some, depending on which way that goes.
Right. Do we have any sense of what's going on with that? I mean, it was supposed to be resolved, you know, a year ago and then 6 months ago, and now we're all waiting around.
I have heard nothing. I mean, I've been trying to keep tabs on it since it's something I will need to write about whenever we get some kind of ruling. But I hear no chatter about it. I hear much more chatter about Google Editions. But as far as when we get a Judge Chin ruling on the amended settlement, I have no idea. Could be today. Could be 6 months from now, you know.
It's right. Funny you mentioned Google Editions, because I was just about to bring that up, because Google Editions, and again, for those who don't know, Google Editions is essentially the Google ebook store, right? You know, Google selling electronic copies of some of the books that it scanned, the in-copyright books that it has scanned. And it was actually supposed to go live this past summer and is now delayed. They have, I think I read an article said, oh, maybe fall. I wouldn't be surprised if the delay in that has to do with the Google Books settlement as well.
Might well.
Yeah, well, from the sublime, the National Digital Library, to the mundane individual libraries. Jen, you were at a conference in, you said, I think, Charleston, where one of the hot topics was patron-driven acquisition. What is patron-driven acquisition? Sounds like print-on-demand to me.
Well, it has that. It can have that component. The conference I was at was the Charleston conference, which is it's been going for about 30 years now. It's not associated with any particular professional association, you know, not the ALA or anything like that. But it's where librarians and publishers and some vendors of materials to libraries, you know, people like Ebrary, Yankee Book Peddler, where they all get together to talk about this very practical as well as larger thematic issues that are affecting all of them. It's an interesting gathering. It's not an unconference, but it's less formally organized than a lot of the scholarly conferences I've been to. But anyway, I think I counted at least 9 sessions out of a 3-day program on this patron-driven acquisition. It comes in a lot of models, a lot of flavors, if you will. I'll give you an example of one of these. An academic library can get from its vendor a bunch of catalog records for ebooks. Drop those those records into its catalog as if it already owned those books, so that users, you know, you or I can go in that catalog and we're clicking through and we'll see those books, those ebooks, and be able even to pull them up and read through them as if they were already part of the library collection. And depending on the parameters that the library and the vendor decide on, there are certain trigger events that will result in a purchase of that book. If 2 or 3 users select the same book and spend some time browsing it or printing out parts of it, that can be a trigger event. You can set a number of different options for what demonstrates enough interest on the part of your users. But a lot of librarians are trying this, and with fairly good results. They can burn through a lot of money quickly doing this, you know, because people a lot of if they don't set the trigger events correctly, but it they know that that users are interested in these particular books because the users have shown that by using them. Now there's some argument about how much use really constitutes genuine research interest, but it's a much more targeted way of buying materials than just going in and guessing what people are going to want out of a publisher's catalog, or these approval plans that a lot of libraries use, where they say, I want everything from Oxford University Press and classics, and then 50% of it doesn't get used within 5 or 10 years. 50% is the very general statistic one hears a lot in the library world about how much material just sits on the shelf.
You know, I just figured out how to make my next book an academic bestseller. That was while you were describing that, I formulated my plan, and that is I'm going to hire a group of undergraduate students, or maybe even just high school students, and they're going to go to the websites of all these university libraries around the country and request copies of my book. And Dan and I think alike on this.
One nice thing is that the user in most cases has no idea that his or her actions might trigger a purchase. As far as you can tell, it's just there in the catalog for you. So there's a little more.
I still love this idea of gaming the system.
Yeah. Well, people used to do it with search, right? They would hire companies to search requests over and over. So,
but you can see. All you have to do is assign your own book in your classes. You can't just be old-fashioned about it and do it that way.
Which, by the way, I found out just the other day, just as a total aside, that that's not illegal in the state of Virginia. It's illegal in the state.
It's not illegal.
It's illegal in Texas, where I used to work. But so, I'm just surprised. Now I know how to make more money. Write books, which I
know. I live off the $13 that I get each semester from my my royalty check. So, Jen, I have a couple of questions. How do libraries answer the question, first of all, of the, the serendipitous, bumping into it on the shelves question, which, I don't know if I've got that question, but maybe at some large research libraries, there'd be people who would kind of wonder about that question, that if it's not physically present, and that's their method of kind of browsing, that's an issue. There's that question. And then what about the overall market for academic books? If really what we're talking about here is it's sort of like lean production, which came out of Japan in the 80s, places like Toyota, where, there'd be very little inventory until you absolutely needed the product, and then the product would exist. What about, as you said, I think almost very casually, the fact that this might lead to a lot of libraries to just unsubscribe from buying every classics book from OUP.
Right. Well, I think librarians are getting much more comfortable with that idea. But going back to your first question about the serendipity of browsing, one thing that struck me as I was interviewing librarians about PDA, sort of a lovely acronym for this concept, patrons, both students and faculty members, are getting much more comfortable using ebooks and just getting the book on their computers, their laptops, wherever they are, not going to the stacks anymore. Though, of course, there always will be people who love the browsing of actual books on actual shelves, particularly in fields like art history, where ebooks have not really caught up yet to what the field expects and needs. The librarians will also tell you, truthfully, that they're not doing away with print acquisitions. In fact, they can use some of these models for print acquisitions too. So it's not, in most cases, it's not like all the books on the shelves are going away and you'll only be able to get them through your computer. But going on to the question of what about, this object only exists when it's wanted. One thing that I found fascinating when I was talking to librarians about PDA was that they're keeping statistics on usage of books by publisher, which if I were a publisher, I'd find very scary. And I think that what they're seeing is that the reputation of a publisher does not necessarily guarantee that its books are really going to be used. So I think the librarians are hoping that this will get publishers thinking harder about what they're publishing. It wouldn't be, maybe some of these books shouldn't be published or shouldn't be published in this form. There's a lot of waste in this system. arguably, and this may be a way to help publishers think through more carefully what they're doing, which gets us into a lot of the you know, raging debates about tenure and promotion criteria and credentialing and all those good things that we talk a lot about on Twitter and elsewhere.
Right.
Twitter, I've heard of that. you know, I have to say, though, I had to smile when you said PDA because, okay, when I was in high school, PDA was public display of affection. Too much PDA was kind of gross. And then there was the personal digital assistant, and now there's patron-driven acquisition. Okay.
Right. But I like it because it is PDA. It's a public display of affection for a particular book.
Exactly. So people expressing their love.
Now, Amanda, you had mentioned Amazon's plan to become a kind of a limited lending library. Does this sound like a similar development, a connected development?
Well, yeah, actually, yes and no. What I was thinking before you gave us that great explanation, Jen, was that you know, if you have a Kindle or an iPad, there really isn't any way for a library to buy an ebook and then lend that ebook to, you know, 50 patrons, unless, of course, you buy the device itself, download a book onto that, and then download, you know, loan the device out. So I was, you know, it has all. I've often thought that somebody clever should come up with some way for, I don't know, people to buy an ebook on their Kindle and somehow share that back up to the library, so that you could, you know, I don't know, you could borrow a Kindle from the library, buy a book on it, read it once, be done with it, and then give the Kindle back to the library so that other people could then read that book, something like that. But yeah, Mills, I know what you're referring to is the fact that the Kindle is now has a very mild and limited form of lending, which is good, but it's so limited as to be useless for libraries, and actually, I think kind of useless for most individuals too. Mm-hmm. You can, you know, it sort of guts the whole copyability of ebooks generally. You know, that of digital files. You know, you can loan it for 14 days if the publisher allows it, only once, and while you've loaned it out, you cannot yourself read it. So, you know, I think it's a sop to people who hate the fact that you can't lend books on Kindles and Nooks and so on. So,
I was really struck by that you know, it's dependent on the publisher's pleasure. You know, whereas with the print book, of course, you just, you know, the publisher has no control over what you do with it once you once it's in your hands. But this way, yeah, you really are dependent on their good graces.
But it's a good thing. And I have to say that, you know, thinking about this a good bit, you know, say that we live in a world in which all books are electronic, which I don't know that we'll ever get to that world, but say that we do. And then, you know, what happens to the library in that world? And I think that it honestly would not bother me a huge amount if, you know, the model of the library as we know it, whether a research library, a university, or a public library, goes away, as long as ebooks remain cheap enough to where you really can get them when you need them. And that's what I'm worried won't happen. I think that in a world where almost everything is an ebook that is a book at all, there has to be some kind of public right to acquire that information without having to pay a whole lot for it. So,
Right. I mean, I think that we're going to end up with, in the next few years, a lot of what, when I try to get an audiobook out of their electronic audiobooks, you know, files, essentially, from my local public library. And, of course, it only works on Windows. It's entrapped in some kind of horrific DRM that I can never get to work. And so I have to boot my Mac into Windows to try to get this all to work. And it's got all kinds of crazy restrictions that, you know, while I'm listening to it, somebody else can't listen to it, even though it's a digital file. And, you know, it's just made with so much friction that, you know, where I think very few people use it, which is probably fine to the lenders. You know, I assume we'll get a lot of that. You know, I kind of wonder what will happen to libraries of the size we have here at Mason. You know, the 1 to 2 million volume you know, pretty much a recent, you know, past 100 years, you know, doesn't have a deep catalog of rare books. You know, what happens to that world in Amanda's scenario? What happens to that kind of library? I mean, I still get the Library of Congress, your Harvard's, your University of Michigan's, but it's hard to imagine, I don't know, it's hard to give the rationale for why, you know, Fenwick Library here sticks around. It's a lot of heating and it's a lot of physical time and it's a lot of people. And I love libraries, but I'm just saying, you know, aside from that fact of a kind of upstairs, downstairs, well, this is where the poor people go to get their sad old printed books. you know, what happens to it? Because it's not really a place where now people are starting their research, as Jen just said.
Right. And I should just clarify really quickly that the only reason I'm you know, even semi-okay with that future in which there are no free ebooks is that there is a lot of free stuff on the internet, right? There's a lot of free information on the internet that isn't a book.
Right.
So. Yeah. One thing I'm hearing from librarians a lot as I go to these conferences and do interviews with them is that they're redefining themselves not as a place but as service providers. There was a fascinating presentation at Charleston given by a medical librarian from Johns Hopkins University. They have a medical school library, obviously, and they have been given. I think they've been told to get rid of 80% of their print books by 2012, and they're repurposing the library building. The building itself is going to be something else. It's not going to be a library. What they're doing is embedding the librarians within specific departments of the medical school, so that the library the patrons, they said, just weren't coming to the library anymore. So the library has to go to the patrons. Now that's probably, given the nature of medical training, a more extreme example than many libraries would be confronted with. But the librarian said that basically said that we're a set of services now. We're no longer an institution of cultural memory. So this was very interesting.
I find that very interesting because it's so reminiscent of a conversation that Tom and I never mentioned that Tom was not on the podcast today. Tom unfortunately couldn't join us, but sends his best wishes to all of our listeners. But Tom and I had this conversation with one of the big telecom providers about doing some mobile apps several years ago, and they told us at the time that they felt like their business model as a telephone company was already over, and that although it was just sort of their legacy business, and that really what they were planning to be was content providers. And that's clear, you know, and this was before the smartphone. And so, you know, clearly they had it called correctly. I mean, the phone companies, although people still do use their phones to make telephone calls, they use it less and less for that purpose. I'd be interested to see what the sort of overall use of a smartphone is in terms of calls versus, you know, other kinds of, you know, data that pass through the phone. Well, I think it's very clear that you know, libraries are in a tremendous transitional period, and it's completely unclear to me anyway, and I think to most people in the library business as well, how it's all going to turn out. So we'll stay tuned. Briefly, at the end of the show today, I want to ask Dan to tell us a little bit about a new development at the Center for History and New Media, Omeka.net. Dan, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, this is intended to replace all libraries worldwide.
And archives. Don't forget archives.
That's right. Yeah.
I think this idea has legs.
we're trying to hasten the end time. And I'm just kidding.
It's the fifth horseman of the apocalypse.
The audience has already labeled Amanda as a library hater, and I'm worried now I'm getting the same thing. All right. No, I'm just joking. people may know Omeka. It's one of our two big open source software projects here at CHNM. And like all of the things we do, it's intended to try to sort of make easier a lot of the more difficult digital things that people do at digital humanities centers, one of which is getting digital collections online and making a nice looking website and making collections searchable, scannable, and also extending them to include things like maps or exhibits or contextualization or note-taking capabilities. And so Omeka is something that really has developed specifically in the last 2 years here at CHNM, but really comes out of really a decade's worth of of generalized code for making, you know, online collections that are really nice to look at, are easy to look through, but also have really rigorous backends that adhere to standards, library standards, yes, digital library standards, archival standards, and are really easy to administer, even if you have no technical experience. So Omeka, for the past couple of years, it's almost coming up on a couple of years, has been available for free. Everything we do is free and open source, of course, but you had to have your own server or know how to use a host to install Omeka before uploading or scanning your collection and putting it online and putting it into exhibits and putting a theme or a skin on top of that. So what we've done now is the project was always intended to really help out museums, libraries, and archives that maybe didn't have their own IT staff, technical staff. And we've taken that a step further by actually now providing our own hosting for people who don't even want to download it and install it, but just want to get right going with a collection. And we're charging on a cost recovery basis. It's really quite modest. The plans, I think, start at $49 a year, which will, I think, be good enough for a lot of small digital collections to go online. So, you know, not much more than a hosting plan would cost, or probably even less in some cases than a hosting plan would cost on a per month basis. But if you go to omeka.net, omeka.net, you can find out about the Omeka plan. And there's even what I'm really excited about for pedagogical uses. There's a free plan that you can sign up for. So if you've got students, you can have them sign up for the free plan, and they can host a small collection and just sort of get used to what it's like to put a digital collection together, what it takes to kind of get things organized online, and then to just begin with playing around with some of the Omeka plugins and geolocation and all the kind of fun things we do in digital humanities. So It's a really good way to get started. And we don't really think there's anything else out there like it. And so if you're interested, try it out. There's also larger institutional plans for universities and large museums and libraries if they want to just buy a blanket plan and roll out as many online exhibits as they want or digital collections as they want. They can go ahead and do that too for modest cost.
Hey, Dan, can I ask a question?
Sure.
On the microblogging service, which shall not be named, I noticed that several people, it looked as though a lot of people were kind of interested in this, you know, bigger than big plan, like interested in getting customized plans. Is that right? Yeah. I was surprised by that.
Yes.
Sorry.
No, that's
no
good.
Offense.
Pleasantly
so,
surprised.
I know.
Pleasantly
I was say, surprised. Oh, thank you, Amanda, for asking about our extra large super plans. This week only, listeners to the Digital Campus podcast get 50% off. No. Yes, of course. We have gotten already some calls, and actually this is done through a nonprofit that we spun off from CH&M called the Corporation for Digital Scholarship, which also runs the payment systems for Zotero storage. And so all this goes into a 501c3 corporation with a board that actually includes librarians and others to administer the financials and the governance of that. And so there are contact points if you go to omeka.net for contacting people at CDS, the Corporation for Digital Scholarship, to talk about bigger plans. Because yes, we can pretty much provide, you know, unlimited storage plans.
Well, I mean, the reason I was surprised to see that was just that I had thought of, you know, the people who would want hosted services as being small organizations that don't have, you know, technical people on staff and don't have a technical infrastructure. So I thought that it would be like this rare case where somebody would want, you know, the huger than huge plan. And this actually relates to something, you know, that we didn't put in the lineup, but that I'll just mention. It's similar to a university going to Google Apps or Google Email, which I noticed a couple of universities did this last week. NYU decided to move all its email to Google Apps and things like that. So to me, it seems to suggest that here are these big institutions that, you know, don't want to take on the burden of
right.
hosting and managing something itself.
No, I think that's true. I think we were caught off guard by that a little bit as well. And, you know, some of these systems are incredibly expensive in the same way that moving to Gmail or Microsoft's online email is a huge savings cost, not only just in, you know, annual licensing, but also just in, you know, people, you know, and technical infrastructure savings. So actually, in retrospect, it doesn't surprise me that some of these large organizations, which are used to paying tens of thousands of dollars for an equivalent to a digital collections management system, for $1,000 a year can get essentially a very large plan. So, you know, we're trying to do here, I think, what we've tried to do in other places, which is what's going on in the web in general, which is that the cost of these things have come way, way down. And that there are these legacy systems that cost, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year that are being replaced by much less expensive web apps with relatively inexpensive and much easier to use plans. So
and cloud storage.
And cloud storage and the virtualization of storage, which has come way down in price. So, you know, if you don't know much about Omeka, go to omeka.org. And of course, it's still and will always be free. It's under a GPL license. So if you know what you're doing, you can do that as well. And actually, there are web hosts that will roll out an Omeka site for you. But we just wanted to make something that is just drop dead simple. I mean, literally, you just type in your email address and a password, and you can get going and start uploading things. And then if you need more storage later on, you can just add that as you wish. So this is really, I think, a very common kind of freemium model that you see now on the open web. And we hope it'll be a big success. And, you know, institutions that subscribe to the funded service will also get the warm fuzzies of knowing that that money is channeled through a nonprofit back into further development of the general open source Omeka platform.
Hmm. Well, thank you very much, Dan. And just speaking as somebody who tried it out in my class on Thursday right after it was announced, I can say the students figured it out in about 3 minutes and went and just ran with it. So it worked. It worked extremely well in the classroom environment. Huh. Well, we've reached the end of another Digital Campus podcast. Jen, thank you so much for joining us.
And good to be here.
Great to have you as always. And thanks everybody for listening. And we will talk to you soon on another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself. Thank you.